experiment in collaborations with several other people. So this clock here has recently been characterized to about 1 × 10⁻⁙ sort of in popular terms. That is a clock that loses 1 second at about 350 million years, just for reference. So it's slightly better than the one I have on my wrist. Another thing that is very nice about being around the Boulder is that there's always a nice weather. And I think both Eric and Jim can back me up on that one, that you have at least 200 plus days of nice sunshine. This is not just a luck. And of course, the next thing is that we have Gila and NIST in within like 4 kilometers. So we have Gila where we have a strontium clock operating, and then at NIST where we have both aluminium ions and mercury ion clocks, together with ytterbium and calcium clocks that we can explore. So there's a fiber connection, but I will come back to that.
It's actually an old acronym for
Joint Institute of Laboratory Astrophysics, I think. But that no longer holds.
Well, there is some astrophysics there, but I'm not sure it's exactly that. So let me just outline the clock that we have. It consists essentially of three components, and those three components are a local oscillator,
an ultra-stable laser source that I will describe more in detail in a second, an optical frequency comb, an octave-spanning frequency comb, and then atoms loaded into an optical lattice, a one-dimensional optical lattice. So that's basically a retroreflected wave that you can actually make a dipole trap, make small pancakes, where you trap about 100 atoms per pancake. In total, we have about 4,000 atoms. And this provides sort of the quantum reference for our clock. So that can act back on a slow creep back to our ultra-stable laser. This will be done in the cycles of half a second to a second. So it happens every half a second to a second, but it's destructive. So every time we have made one measurement, we will have to reload the lattice again, cool the atoms and so forth, and then make spectroscopy and act back again on the atoms. The optical frequency comb we use to lock the laser that keeps the atoms in the optical trap. And at the same time, it enables us to be able to compare to other clocks, say at NIST. So it serves actually two purposes: the optical clock or the optical frequency comb.
Because the dimensions are wrong different on different sides.
This is dimensional as well.
Aha, and on the right, it's 1/√ of tau.
Yeah. Maybe it is. It could be. Probably the cycle time. Using the big T. So the stable local oscillator is a direct laser source that we stabilize to ultra high finesse cavity. The finesse of this cavity is about 250,000.
And it's mounted in a thermal isolated environment, and it's in a mechanical isolated environment. And by having two such lasers and beating them against each other, we can see that we are below 1 hertz line width for the laser. And scanning out the frequency response of the strontium atoms, you will typically see something like that if you have enough probe time. And that's about 2.1 hertz. The record that we have carried out so far is 1.8 hertz. And we have made some improvements, so we think we can actually go a little bit below that. But essentially, that limit here is we're limited by the thermal noise in the mirrors that stabilize our lasers. So in order to do a lot better, we have to do something different there. So essentially, how is this operated? It starts by cooling atoms that comes out of an oven. They're 800 Kelvin hot. So we cool them down to about a millikelvin using this fast transition, cycling transition. Then we switch that off and switch on a new one, a red cooling transition that is more narrow, so we can get lower temperatures. And we get about 1 to 2 microkelvin and load them into the optical lattice. And then we use this transition here, which is a single this 0 to 2 P0, forbidden transition sort of, with a line width about 1 millihertz as a clock transition. So the experiment starts by cooling down atoms that are very hot and loading them into a lattice where we cool them further down and then interrogating with the clock laser. So sort of all these atoms sitting in these pancakes provided by the optical lattice can be regarded as three-dimensional harmonic oscillators. I will just look at them here as one-dimensional harmonic oscillators. And we are basically in the Lambdicke regime, which means that we can forget about Doppler effects and we can forget about recoil effects. So the recoil frequency is typically 4.6 kilohertz, which is a lot less than the trap frequency, which is like 80 kilohertz in our case. And obviously, the clock line width of 1 millihertz is a lot less than the trap frequency. So we are in the well-resolved sideband regime. So what we do here is that we trap the atoms in an optical lattice at the magic wavelength, where the differential Stark shift from those two states cancel out at a magic wavelength, which is in our case about 830 nanometers. And that is, of course, doing the whole experiment locked to the optical, basically to the optical, to the clock transition. So we know that it sits there stable, but it's not that it's very important to have that issue, since it's not that sensitive though, if you just sit in the vicinity here, as you can see. If you look a little bit on the possibilities of cooling down atoms while sitting in an optical lattice like that, you can use something like sideband cooling. So I've illustrated that here with a scan of the frequencies from these three transitions, essentially, with and without sideband cooling. And you can see the blue case here that we essentially remove the sideband over here when we have the sideband cooling working, meaning that we have a temperature here which is close to about 1 millikelvin, maybe 1.5 millikelvin. So how's the clock really operated? Well, we actually, to obtain a more pure sample, we spin polarize our sample. So we start out in the red case here with a lot of different MF states. And then perpendicular to the lattice, we put a magnetic field, a weak magnetic field that is, of course, stabilizing current and so forth. And then we can actually do polarization, a polarization pulse that polarizes the atoms to two states like that, plus 9.5 and minus 9.5. And then we lock in different runs. We lock first to this two, and then we lock to those two. And the idea, of course, is that the sum of those two will have a frequency that is independent of the magnetic field. So that's the whole point. So first we lock to those two, and then to those two, and we carry on like that for a long time. Each half second, we repeat that cycle. So the first order Simon shift is canceled. Actually, also for those of you who knows about this, is the vector shift is also canceled because that's proportional to MF. And the tensor shift we can just absorb into the magic wavelength value. Just to take a preliminary data here of the strontium clock at JITA versus the ytterbium clock, the neutral ytterbium clock at NIST, an Allen clock here of about almost 6,000-7,000 seconds, starting at a few times 10 to minus 15 and averaging down. Now the last few points here normally in an Allen plot like that, you cannot trust so much. They are not the points that you should trust most. I should also say that this is actually not the best one we have. This is actually one of the ones that are not so good. But in this, we always try to be a little bit pessimistic on our values. It's better to be conservative, to be too optimistic with the values. And I do think that we can reach down below 10 to minus 16 level with these two clocks, actually. I do think that this is very reasonable within foreseeable future. And this could be interesting for comparing variations in alpha and also in mu in this case here. The thing that we have done so far is, well, first of all, characterized our clock by comparing to the NIST calcium clock, neutral calcium clock. You can see here two traces of the Allen plot. One is from the strontium versus NIST maser. And the other one is the optical comparison, as also mentioned by Jim, that once you have two optical clocks and compare them, you average down very fast and you start far down. So at about a couple of hundred seconds, we're already at 3 times 10 to minus 16. So that means that if you want to change, if you want to characterize your clock in terms of stability and perturbations and so forth, then it's nice to have something where you can change it every 100 seconds or 200 seconds. and then see what will happen at this level. So that essentially means that you can do a fast optical comparison. I should mention that there is a 4 kilometer fiber between GILA and NIST, and that is actually Doppler compensated in the sense that the transfer here, the optical transfer from GILA to NIST, which is like 10 to minus 18 in 200 seconds. So we're not limited by that transfer at all. So we can phase coherently compare to clocks at NIST from GILA, which is a very nice feature. Just to show you a few graphs of how we evaluated the systematic part of the clock. So by changing each of the parameters that you have in mind, could be a lot, and there is a lot of parameters that you should change there, like what is the magnetic field, what is the trapping laser intensity, and so forth. There's a huge bunch of things that you have to go through here, and luckily, every 200 seconds you can vary those things and get a pretty good answer out in say one night measurement, like 40 hours measurement. If you had to do that with the maser, it will take you years, maybe even more than that. And here's an example of the frequency shift due to variations of the AC stark shift of the trapping laser, here reported at 3 kilowatts per square centimeter. There's also a curve here showing the linear and the quadratic Zeeman shift, where the insert, maybe the most important plot, is showing the sum of the two frequencies, how they are independent of the magnetic field, as you can see here, since nicely centered around zero. And the last thing that, at least in the beginning, puzzled us a little bit is that it seems like we, even though we have fermions, that we have actually a frequency shift that we can detect. And that frequency shift seems to be dependent on the excitation fraction. And it was not really clear to us because fermions at low temperatures, in principle, should not have any, they should not see each other. There should only be P wave scattering. So what was going on there? And I'm not going to talk much about that, so I'm just going to scroll a little bit by that, but I'll just mention a few things about it in a second. So the two major things that really sort of limit us at this stage here is basically the black body radiation, the fact that, well, we are sitting in a temperature environment that's not zero, and that you have a temperature fluctuations on a big experimental apparatus of this size here. I mean, you cannot control that below like 1 millikelvin or something like that. And on top of that, we don't know the polarizabilities. This is something for the theorists. We don't know the polarizabilities of strontium good enough to actually be able to really evaluate that number here. And I know that Sergey Porsev, I guess some of you guys know very well, has done new calculations on that. And that will basically get our uncertainty down there by a factor of at least 2. So magically, this will drop down almost to the 10 to minus 17 level by doing some nice theory, which is very nice. So I'm not going to talk much about collisions with almost identical fermions, but just saying that, we could have had collisions from atoms in plus 9.5 and minus 9.5 state, since that's the way we prepared the clock. When we tried to do an experiment, or actually we did the experiment, we removed one part, so we only had one spin state left, and still we see quite a bit of a density shift, and it amounts almost to 2 hertz for a density of about 1 × 10^11 atoms per cubic centimeter. And we asked the question, could it be P wave? I don't think so, because P wave threshold is about 30 microkelvin. So we asked, well, what happens here? Isn't that when we prepare the atoms that they're not exactly identical? And I believe at least that this is really the case. And you could look at it like having two electrons that collide where the angle is a little bit different. Why that? Because that's essentially the same as having a two level atoms. It will be the same situation there. And when you calculate the density shift you should have from mean field theory, you would get something like a correlation function, which is given by this value here, where you have the two states sitting up here. And we believe that this shows that when the atoms are not prepared in exactly the same way, that means that they have a little bit different Rabi frequency when you excite them for the clock pulse. it's not identical fermions anymore. They are not identical. That means that they can actually collide now. And that factor here, which is normally zero for identical fermions, is not zero in the real life experimental case. Yes, the shift is all the same sign, you mean?
Yeah, so this respects the sign every time you make the measurement. Otherwise, it will just be one big curve that was filled up with points. It's always the same. And when we do the measurements, we actually do another thing as well. We do first this measurement, then maybe this one, then maybe this one, then maybe this one. We don't always, you know, go like, because you can easily introduce a systematic effect in that way. We think we can control it, so it's not a big problem. So also that parameter, I think we can control by finding the most advantageous point where.
I should think about this because you have some gradient in your Rabi frequency. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so there's a distribution of Rabi frequencies. They're not all the same coming out in the same. So that means that sort of in the circle spin model, that they will change a little bit angle with respect to each other.
Well, I will come to that and say I don't think actually that will solve everything, but it could solve some of it, but not everything. But it's a good point that, I mean, of course, there's two ways of getting that. That is basically, I mean, if you misalign your probe with respect to the lattice, or if you look at it, if it's too tightly focused, then there will still be a spread of the K vectors that will give rise to sort of different Rabi frequencies. And if you look at it, what you should really do is to sum up for all n, nx, and ny, and nc in this harmonic oscillator, you should really sum up all the sinc square from there. And if you really do that carefully, you can see here the black curve is at 2.1 microkelvin compared to theory at 0 kelvin. So there's a huge difference, actually. And from scanning those profiles out, we can actually infer pretty well the temperature from our atoms. So that's another way of probing the temperature of the atoms by doing spectroscopy. So we have also done some temperature dependent frequency shift. I will not talk too much about that. I think I would like to go and talk about this huge international effort that has been on a strontium versus cesium plot. And it's done over several years. And you can see here the first plots from Tokyo, Boulder, and Paris. And here are some of the recent experiments. And you can see here that these experiments, actually, they agree with each other on the level of 5 times 10 to minus 16, which is pretty good for three independent groups, I would say. And on the second hand, having a system like this has actually now been accepted as a secondary standard. And I think there will come a lot of more groups adding to this kind of plot. So that gives good confidence in both absolute and stability. For this system. How many secondary standards? I'm not sure about how many exactly. You can maybe answer that.
Different conditions.
What does it mean, primary and secondary? Primary is a single standard.
Primary? You mean a Kiechel situation?
Cesium clock, and how many?
The rubidium hydrofine structures, the secondary standard is a microwave, and then optically there is the strontium atom, and the mercury, the ytterbium, and the strontium ion.
Before,
today.
Yeah?
Today.
Thank you.
Yeah, about four. So, so that's a really nice feature of this system here. It gives nice confidence. So, together with Victor, we looked at what would be the possibilities of looking at with all that data we have as a function of time, what would be the possibility of constraining the fundamental constants? So, from linear drift of this thing here, you could. You can get a constraint on the limit on the fundamental constant, and from the sort of the sidereal variations here, you would give you can get some information about at least how the constant should be coupled to gravity as the Earth goes around the Sun. But that's that is a very weak effect. The gravity change here is only like 3 × 10⁻¹⁰, so it's not a huge change in the gravity. But anyway, this is one of the first experiments really showing that. And I should maybe write up the formula because I forgot I can see to put it on there that the fractional frequency change, which you could write like this. So we compare to cesium, so that means that if we have clock J, we will have the relative variations to cesium, something like this thing here. And this you can write up as a this we can write up like a variation. Since it's cesium, that means there's a magnetic moment there, so there must be a contribution both from the electron to proton mass ratio, but there will also be a contribution from alpha. So I will write it up like this. Just actually, we can write it like this. This is maybe better. So this is sort of our measured parameter here, and this parameter here for strontium, that's about 2.77 minus 2.77. For other systems that has been compared to cesium, like the hydrogen mesa and mercury plus. For mercury plus, this is around 6.03, I think, something like that. So with that in mind, we can fit linearly this the first part and get this coefficient out that puts constraint on the yes.
Yes. Since Bohler is at 1500 meters, you know,
yes.
So you have to make a huge correction for that.
That's it? True. We have to come.
Is there an uncertainty introduced by doing that?
Apparently not, as you can see. Well, we're hitting right. I mean, I would say the 1500 meter, that is not really our job at GLA, because people at NIST really take very good care of that. They have their own way of comparing to people in Paris, say. They have extreme. I mean, they both with satellites and other methods that they can actually compare. And they go. They've taken care of those this part. But we are not sitting exactly at level with GLA. And this. So we have there's about 11 meters difference that we have to take into account, and that we have measured with the GPS. If you want to go further below this, then you might come into trouble because we don't really know where the geo is.
Depends what you want. If you look for cesium is sitting at the same geoid as strontium at each of the sites, so it just doesn't matter.
No, in this case, yeah, that's true. For the absolute number, I guess you should. You should take into account that
no.
The height difference between GLA and this, right?
That's
I
true.
Mean, that's 11 meters, so we must be able, I mean, we must take that into account, right?
But it's not Tokyo. Tokyo doesn't matter.
No, Tokyo doesn't matter. No,
Tokyo have their own light, their own standards.
In Paris, too.
I'm not sure that they have their own.
They don't have season standards. What do they compare?
I don't know.
What do you compare to?
GPS or.
Yeah, you have GPS, right?
Yeah, and in MFIJ, they have cesium function.
Okay.
But it's already operational and compatible with strontium measurement. It was always a problem with quality of cesium fountain.
Yeah.
So now it's not a problem anymore?
We still have a problem. And I think people have a reference of DAI.
Yeah.
By subtracting.
I guess you have a new number you can write.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one more number that adds to this thing here. And I'm pretty sure that will continue for some time. So we get better and better data. The problem is that we get better and better data of here. All the physics sort of sit out here because here the fits are not really constrained by those quite so much.
The issue is that this is the best choice for lattice, or perhaps
for lattice?
Yeah, or perhaps other atoms could be better, like ytterbium.
I'm not sure about that. I can't answer that. I can only say that there's plans to go to three-dimensional optical lattice to try to do a better job. But whether ytterbium is better or strontium is better, I don't know. We only compare them. We have time to time. We have runs where all four clocks are present. So that means the mercury, the aluminium plus, and then the strontium and the ytterbium.
Oh, which ytterbium?
There's ytterbium at NIST. There's a ytterbium clock there. Neutral.
Neutral.
Yeah.
Oh.
So we expect a lot of things to from this.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. On the first points that you have here are at ant angles. So
yes, I mean, I don't know if it's unfortunate. I mean, it's just that's the way it happens to be. So, I mean, we will make more. I mean, there will be more points here. There will be more experiments out here constraining with a better stability, a better accuracy. That can put better constraint on this. But this is the data we have so far, so I can't really do much about
it. So just to show impressive progress.
I just explained how you get the error bar on the sinusoidal flip bit.
Well, that's, I mean, we. So again, there's procedures so you can fit points with error bars on that, and it comes out of that fit. It's not just from a function. You can actually show, you can put up a sinusoidal fit on a number of points with error bars on, and that will give you error bars on the fit coefficient.
Is there any, do you use a certain fitting technique?
No, we do it by hand. We do the math ourselves.
7 points is possible.
Yeah, if it's 2,000 points, I don't know. So the constraints that we get out of this is consistent with zero at this level here, at the 10 to minus 16 and 10 to minus 15 level per year so far. Maybe more interesting. It was disappearing here before, wasn't it? Maybe it was just me. So, I mean, you can test linear model as proposed by Flambeau and co-workers that you have some kind of parameter here. The fractional change in that parameter is some kind of constant times the change in the gravitational potential. And how does that look like for spontium, say? Well, that's the 2.77 value that you have here, and k alpha plus k mu. There will not be any kq for this. The dependence on the small quark masses, and you can do the same thing for Mercury plus, and you can do the same thing for the Mesa, and for those three you get three equations with three unknown, and you can again do the same thing. Basically, you will have a plane now that constrains the values that you're looking at, and putting in uncertainties for all these measurements. Looked up in literature, you can actually constrain the couplings to gravity for alpha and for mu and for q in this way here. But I guess there will be other talks on how to do that with gravitational measurements. I don't know.
I'm wondering, is it actually a free-running H Mesa, or I thought that the NIST Mesas would somehow be steered to.
I'm not sure that's a free, I don't think that's a free running Mesa, but what do you say? Is that a free running Mesa, this measurement here?
The Mesa frequencies are corrected periodically, or measured periodically.
So it should fall, but then it should be regarded as a representation of the Cesium drop, shouldn't it?
No, it's Mesa to Cesium.
I thought he.
This is comparison of Mesa to Cesium. All of them has to be to Cesium. Right? But this thing here to work.
No, but I think this is just free running Mesa in that sense for what you plotted. I'm not sure what you
plotted. The NIST group published the result as a ratio of hyperfine transition in
to cesium.
In hydrogen divided by hyperfine transition in cesium. This is how they published the result.
Okay.
So what they actually done, I have no idea.
All of them are comparison to cesium, right?
All three numbers are comparison to cesium.
Uh-huh. So
strontium to cesium, this number is F strontium is strontium to cesium. Mercury is mercury to cesium, mercury plus to cesium, optical mercury to plus to cesium, and here hyperfine to hyperfine.
So maybe with the ytterbium plot, it could be interesting to carry that on more detail also, or with some of the other plots, obviously, to get more points on this plot. So there's been a lot of people involved in the optical elevation of strontium, the absolute frequency measurements, cesium, the optical carrier transfer between GILA and NIST. Ultrafone collisions, we have quite a bit of people looking into that, and of course fundamental constants we're in close collaboration with. So thank you for your attention.
So, I mean, with these density shifts, someday you imagine some sort of 3D lattice and modulus layer transitions, and it's just not a problem. Is that the plan someday, or?
Yeah, I mean, one of the plans is to move to a three-dimensional optical lattice, but there might be other problems with vector and tensor shifts there that is not evident, I would say. But maybe Katurovich will talk more about that tomorrow. But if you could, of course, fill an atom into each site where they cannot really interact, that would be ideal. You probably need to do a BC or something like that before to be able to fill it up with one atom per site.
So back to this one thing about these non-identical fermions.
Yeah.
That the level you've seen it at, is that consistent with, and there's a whole lot of atomic physics data on collisions and things like that, where you see suppression because of this. But is that effect, like this effect is so much smaller than anything you've observed there, or?
Yeah, so I mean, it is a pretty small effect at only 10 to 11 atoms per cubic centimeter. I mean, there's about 100 atoms per pancake, and we can still see its frequencies here, one verse or something like that. There's not so much known about strontium 87, actually, in terms of scattering length and so forth. So this might be one method to actually determine what is both the sign of it and what's the order of magnitude of it in this case.
Any other questions? In principle, we have time for discussion, but I'm not 100% sure there is something to discuss. If you have a topic, you're very welcome.
But it's usually we should go for banquet sometime earlier, like me.
maybe I'll say a word or two.
Yeah.
Is that yesterday?